Buddy. I'm Danny Marks. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Christy for putting me on the 5 freeway on a Sunday afternoon from the San Fernando Valley. What could I be resentful at? It was an opportunity to drink a Celsius and realize how unspiritually fit I really am. And I'm just here to share that gift with you. So buckle up. I want to thank Sonia for a great talk. Like, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you heard everything you need to hear in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in Sonia's talk. She talked about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and the gift she's received as a result of the practice of the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, for one, am thrilled to have heard you. And if you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. I'm sure you're sweating crystal meth out of your spinal fluid and going, no, I'm really happy for the Jew in the suit. Because when I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard you guys were having a good time, my hope was that you would get hit by a bus after the meeting. Because I got here dying of alcoholism. I got here dying and you guys were like smiling and happy and joyous and free. And there was no way for me to get from where I was to where you were. It was there. I could not see a path there. And if you're new, welcome. And if you're new and you hear nothing else tonight, hear this, you're safe. We need nothing from you. You don't have to do jack around here. My prayer for you is that you try not to have a drink tonight and come back and hang out with us again tomorrow. And if you drink tonight, come back and hang out with us again tomorrow. Because I don't get surprised when we drink. I get surprised when we don't drink. I have sobriety day to tell. I want to thank Christy for asking me. I want to thank Tim for suggesting me to Christy and then not showing up. I think he's on Zoom. It does wonders for my self-esteem when someone suggests me and then doesn't come because I'm not insecure enough. I have a sobriety date. It's April 24th, 1990. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday Night Solution Group meeting. We used to meet at Sherman Oaks Hospital, and now we meet on Zoom. I have a sponsor. He's a little garden gnome in Jerusalem, Israel. His name is Yisrael C., and he knows he sponsors me. And we speak regularly, and I'm right where I belong, which is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got sober, there was a guy named Bill Burns, and he used to say, if I don't tell you how I'm really doing, you can't really help me. So I'm going to tell you how I'm really doing. I'm a little cranky. I'm a little under the weather. I'm a little... I own a small business, and it's been sucking recently, and I'm a little scared, and I don't know what to do. And I got a 22-year-old daughter who I love with every fiber of my being, who is an absolute pain in the ass. And I was supposed to take her to the airport on Friday morning to take her back to college so she could go back to school. And she texted me at 3 a.m. telling me that she had COVID and wasn't going back to school right away. And I love my kid, right? I love when she comes home from college, and I love when she leaves to go back to college. And I feel bad for her. Like, she's starting her senior year, and she's a kid who we have never pushed her. We have never like asked her to do anything other than what she does. And she's going to graduate college in 3 years and 2 classes and start a master's program at the same time. Like, I am so proud of this overachieving pain in the ass. And we have a really difficult relationship because she, unlike me, has incredible self-esteem and can stand up for herself in a reasonable way and doesn't take my crap. And so it's been a little challenging when I need her to be something other than she is, right? And so I was talking to someone during the break about resentments just coming, right? They just come. I don't get to pick and choose when they come. They come. Right. But I got a responsibility to treat them in Alcoholics Anonymous so I don't punish my kid for them. And I drank. Right. I drank copious amounts of alcohol. And I also did a boatload of drugs. And I talk a lot about drugs. And I'm sorry if the talk about drugs offends anybody, because I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. But then I read Bill's story. And on the sixth page of Bill's story, it says he went to a doctor. The doctor gave him a sedative. The next day found Bill taking both gin and sedative. And in Dr. Bob's story, he talks about taking pills in the morning to calm his jitters so he could make it through the workday without a drink and then go home and start drinking. And I thought if drugs were good enough for our founders, they were good enough for me. And yeah, I used to steal anything that said, do not operate heavy machinery. Like, I didn't realize I was 3 years sober when I realized I was stealing antibiotics. And like, I never got high, but I never got sick. So it seemed to work. But I, you know, I get confused in AA all the time. Like, one of the things I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is the spirit of inclusion. Like, everyone is welcome. No one's done too much or suffered too much or has done too much bad stuff to be welcomed into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you tell me that I must stick to my singleness of purpose, my singleness of purpose is to not have a drink one day at a time and sit down with a new guy and show him how I don't drink so that he may have an opportunity to live a life that I was unequipped to live when I got here, right? I drank. My grandfather was a rabbi in Hollywood. And at my bar mitzvah, he invited 1,800 of his congregants to watch the prodigal grandson become bar mitzvahed. And that was the morning of my first drink. And I drank before the bar mitzvah, and I threw up on the pulpit, and I didn't make it through the Torah ceremony. And then, and my grandfather was a little concerned. And then I drank through the party, and I threw up all night through the party. And that's how I started. Like, that's how I started. I didn't start by, like, a little champagne at a wedding. All bets were off my first drink. And I'll never forget the morning after. I had embarrassed my mom, my dad, my grandparents, the congregation. I'd embarrassed anybody who came in my path. And the next morning I woke up and my first thought was, I cannot wait to do this again. I can't. And it talks about it in our literature where maybe it was the Celsius, but I'm speeding. I'm like 15 minutes ahead of where I'm talking right now. So we could be out of here by 8:15. I know for a fact that if you get between me and the drink, I'll kill you to get to the drink. Nothing stands between me and the drink. And I've done all kinds of stuff for a really long time to denigrate and destroy relationships. I was at a meeting last night, and a friend of mine was giving a talk, and she, in her talk, talks about how her mom and dad used to walk up and down Sunset Boulevard asking anybody on the street if they've seen their daughter. Like, and I know that's how I treated my mom, right? That's the stuff, that's how I treated my mom and dad. You get between me and the drink and I'll kill you because I need the drink. And I drank like that from day one. And then I got introduced to pot. I hated pot. Hated it. I smoked it every day for a decade. Hated every minute of it. And I felt like a little puppy on linoleum. You know, like I was really busy, but I never went anywhere. But I was busy. And then I got introduced to cocaine. And I should have known cocaine was a problem. I should have known because I got fronted a dime bag of cocaine. And I did it all, and I knew it wasn't enough, and I refused to pay for it. And I got in a fight with the dealer and the high school quad, first time I ever did cocaine. And did that stop me? Oh, no, because I really enjoy freebasing with sex workers. It's really one of my favorite pastimes. And I would do it tonight, but my wife frowns on it, so I don't. So that's how I did drugs from the giddy up. You know, I used to, like I said, I took anything in any medicine cabinet that I could find, I would take. I really liked snorting speed. I really liked snorting Black Beauties. I really liked Quaaludes. Most of you missed Quaaludes. And I'm so sorry because they were a blast until they weren't anymore. And so I smoked a lot of pot. I did a lot of cocaine. I drank. I couldn't stop drinking. I'll never forget high school graduation weekend. My friend Artie called and said, "We're going to go to my parents' cabin in Lake Arrowhead, and we're each going to get an eight ball, and we're going to go up and celebrate." And I did mine on the drive up, and then I spent. Then I did half of his, and we spent the weekend looking for it. And here's where I start to understand how I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. The next year, my friend Artie calls and says, "It's our 1 year anniversary from our high school graduation. Let's go back up to Arrowhead." I said, "That's great." He goes, "I still have some of that blow left." I'm like, "Are you insane? Like, I've stolen thousands of dollars from my grandmother's wallet between now and then to get what I needed to get, and you still have some left. And here's my thinking. What's wrong with you? Like, what's wrong with you?" Never entered into my consciousness that I had this peculiar mental twist. I'll never forget. I was in college in San Francisco, and I like to date by the hour. And I was driving around the Tenderloin, drinking a bottle of Southern Comfort. And I was looking for my date of the evening, and I found her, and we went up to the 7th floor Tenderloin apartment. And as I was walking out, I got mugged and chased down the stairs by these two very large gentlemen. And they beat me up, and they took my wallet and my keys and my glasses and everything. And I got in the car, and here was my thought. My thought was, I should never go to that building again. Right? A normal person's thought was, "Oh my God, what kind of situation did I put myself into that could have killed me?" But my thought is, I got to find a new building to go to. So if you're new and you relate to that thought process, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You may be in the right place. Because I'll never forget, I got pulled over one night for drinking and driving. And fortunately, I didn't get arrested. But my thought wasn't, I shouldn't drink and drive. My thought was, I should take a different street. You know, and that's what I bring to you guys. So I drank, I did copious amounts of drugs. I did all kinds of stuff that got me into a lot of trouble. And when I was 18 years old, I had been gone for the afternoon. And I came home to find out that my little brother had died in a mountain climbing accident. And 3 weeks later, I was taking a walk with my dad at LA Valley College, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. And it sucked, right? It ripped out every shred of safety and comfort and security and love and understanding that I had as a kid growing up. And I remember going to the rabbi at the time and saying, "What do I do with this? How do I reconcile this? How do I get comfort here?" And the rabbi said, "I shake my fist at God." And I said, "That's not enough. There is no connective tissue there. There is nothing that gives me peace that I can grab onto." And I crawled back into a bottle of Jack Daniels. And I can tell you standing here today that although those experiences helped shape the man I am today, they had zero to do with my alcoholism. Absolutely zero. Because if those caused my alcoholism, I could go to therapy and freebase like a normal guy. But I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. So I went back to college, and I joined a fraternity, and we developed a drink. It was Jack Daniels and peppermint schnapps on the rocks. Seriously? You guys are shooting heroin with dirty toilet water, and you're judging my freaking cocktail? I love AA. I get sober and virginal at the same time. Oh my God, do I love Alcoholics Anonymous judging my drink. You guys are picking up crumbs on the carpet and smoking and judging my drink. But hypocrisy is not one of my defects of character. So I was drinking like that. I ended up in a little apartment in Toluca Lake, California. And I had a grandfather who was a Russian immigrant, and he came to this country with nothing, like zero. He didn't know the language, didn't have a skill set, didn't know anything, landed at Ellis Island as an 18-year-old boy, completely all alone. And he went to school and learned a language and developed a career and tried to leave a better life for his kids and his grandkids than the one he had been given. And I was too loaded to go to the hospital the night he had a heart attack. I was almost too loaded to make it to the funeral. But when they were handing out those checks, I was first in line. And I did whatever I did when I had money at the time. I called an escort service, and she brought a freebase pipe, and she stayed for 6 months. And I don't know about the rest
of the many,
but my first night of cocaine, long-term Neanderthal sexual relations.
I think we've got a couple more. It's a new recipe. It is ready. Yeah, tell me if it's good, because it's a new recipe. So I don't know. The
short, fat, mulleted Jew.
I know, it looks good, but it might not be.
Around his apartment.
It's a linguine.
Ankles, chasing a sex worker for 6 months, getting absolutely nowhere. Like, I hadn't heard the term pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I thought they were normal dating rituals. Like, and thank God I got to AA, where a lot of you guys had that same experience. But my buddies who were in law school and med school were not having that experience. And what happened for me is that my landlord got tired of me not paying rent, and I got asked to leave that apartment by the U.S. Marshals, who kindly helped. But what really happened is that my grandpa, who spent his entire life building a better life with his, for his kids and his grandkids, I smoked it up with a sex worker in 6 months. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what you're bringing to us. I don't know what that black hole of shame is that you're unwilling to separate yourself from. I don't know what that cancer is that's eating you to death, but that's what was killing me. And I was taking that to the grave. And shame was going to kill me faster than alcohol. And I got asked to leave that apartment by the U.S. Marshals. I ended up in a little apartment in West Hollywood, and one night I was doubled over in a whole bunch of pain, and I went to Cedars-Sinai emergency room.
Yeah, we have one tonight. You want it?
Whatever you do, don't drink. I'm like, yeah. And I went home, and by that point, I was drinking two-fifths.
Because then I think we have to wait until
vodka out of the bottle every night. 15th. And my routine was I would come home if I... My routine was I'd get up in the morning, I'd brush my tongue, I'd throw
so
up the
no
vodka
pass?
Before. I'd crawl, back, okay. I'd crawl back into bed. I would drink whatever was left of the vodka. I'd turn on a Highway to Heaven rerun and then see where my day went from there. Like, I used all my sick days by January 3rd and was well into vacation time. And so here's where I start. Here's where I start to understand how the disease of alcoholism manifests itself in me. I believe I play by a different set of rules than anybody else on the planet. And whatever you citizens have to adhere to, don't you know what I've been through? I'm a little different. Hi, my name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. sorry, you really didn't miss anything. So they checked me into the coronary care unit to detox because the detox was too hard for my heart to handle. And then they said I was a candidate for the chemical dependency unit. And I had no idea what that was, except they were giving me Ativan. And I really liked Ativan. And I would follow them around the hospital to get more Ativan. In fact, I would have taken one on the drive down tonight, but I thought Christy may have frowned on that. So I did. So they put me in, they tell me to go to this chemical dependency unit. I have no idea what it is, but they tell me to go play volleyball on Ativan. So I broke my ankle in two places. And then they said, we're going to a place called the Log Cabin. And I thought, cool, pancakes. Like, I can do AA. This is civilized. So you got to understand, I weighed 245 pounds. I had the San Fernando Valley crystal meth speed drummer's mullet. I had a huge bushy beard. I put on my best outfit at the time, which was a purple and gold striped shirt and gold MC Hammer harem pants. And they wheeled me down Beverly Boulevard, up Robertson Avenue at 7 o'clock in the morning and carried me up those little steps to the log cabin. And how you guys knew I was a newcomer, I have no idea. I still don't know. But you were like really kind and here, have some coffee and here, blah, blah, blah. And all I kept thinking was that I'll never forget. I got back to the hospital that night and I wrote in a little journal, I wrote two things. One, walked into a room with a whole lot of people, a whole lot sicker than I am, because I'm a little grandiose and a little judgmental. And two, walked into a room with a whole lot of people, a whole lot more willing to get well than I am. And in that moment, I knew AA couldn't work for me. I knew it. I was destined to die the alcoholic death. And I did 30 days in that unit, and I was the model patient, because I'm an incredibly great opportunist and I know exactly how to tell you what you need to hear to get you off my back. And I did that 30 days in the unit, and they had a coining ceremony and they passed around a coin afterwards. Danny, we love you. Danny, you'll be president of AA someday. Danny, you're an amazing human being. And I put the coin in my pocket and I got in my car and I went to a liquor store and I bought 2/5 of vodka and I went home and I started drinking again. And it talks about me very clearly in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The difference between the heavy drinker and the alcoholic is the heavy drinker, given sufficient reason to stop, stops. I had a distended liver and atrial fibrillation of my heart. I was told if I drink, I'm going to die, and I cannot stop drinking. And it's not that I will not, and it's not that I should not. I cannot replace the cycle of spree and remorse with the cycle of commitment and surrender left to my own devices, no matter what. And on April 23rd, 1990, I was standing on the front porch of my house with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in an overnight bag, waiting for my mom and my baby sister to take me back to the hospital. And that look of pain and fear and terror and sadness and disgust and remorse that I saw in their eyes in that moment, I haven't had to see in anyone's eyes in over 34 years. And if that's as good as Alcoholics Anonymous gets, I can't pay you back in lifetimes. So when Christy says, can you come and talk? You bet your ass I can, because I got two actions in my life. I'm either walking towards a drink or away from a drink. And the more actions I take walking away from a drink, the greater the opportunity I have to live a life that I was ill-equipped to live when I got here. And what I know now that I didn't know then is on April 23rd, 1990, I could not stop drinking. And on April 24th, 1990, the drink problem had been removed. Without any thought or effort on my part, it just had. And what I know now that I didn't know then, that was the beginning of the experience of the touch of the master's hand. Because I couldn't stop drinking on my own, and the drink problem was removed. And I went back to the hospital, and did an 8-day follow-up program. And then I got a sponsor. His name was Bob Braithwaite. He was lovely. One of the sweetest men I've ever met. He had never worked a step. I had never worked a step. We were perfect together. And I called him every morning and I said, hi, Bob, it's Danny. He said, hi, Danny, I love you. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Call me tomorrow. And what he did is he made AA a safe landing spot. Because if someone would have given me tough love or told me what I needed to do or given me instructions, AA couldn't work. You couldn't be harder on me than I was on myself. You couldn't be. I was killing myself. And the only thing that worked for me is someone making AA a welcome place. So if you're new and you haven't heard this yet, welcome. Stay. Please stay. And so, you know, after about 6 months, I needed to work the steps, and I started working the steps with another sponsor, and it was great. And when, you know, he did it out of some pamphlets, and I'm not judging it. Yeah, I'm judging it. But we didn't drink the whole time. And when we got to the ninth step, I went to the cemetery to talk to my dad and my brother and my grandpa and to sit. And you told me, for any of this to have any lasting effect, it must have depth and weight. And although I sat with my dad and my grandpa and my brother, it felt hollow. And I felt like a loser. I felt I couldn't even do this right. And I came back to you and I said, what do I do? Like, I can't even make amends the right way. And you told me to show up, do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll know. And my first sponsor, I got sober in West Hollywood, and AIDS was really rampant at the time. And my first sponsor, Bob, got really sick with AIDS. And I used to go to the hospital and hold his hand and wipe his forehead and change his whatever needed changing. And I didn't do it because I'm a nice guy. I'm a runner. I am not a stayer. This kind of stuff freaks me out and I run, but I stayed, God bless you, and took care of Bob. And when I spoke at his funeral, I sat down and I was a little cleaner with my dad and I was a little cleaner with my brother and I was a little cleaner with my grandpa. So I just kept showing up and doing my job in AA and I started to feel better as a result of that. So the mullet, the hair and pants, the 245, not a lot of dating. I know it's shocking. I know it's shocking, but there was not a lot of action. So I'm a stalker. So I stalked this woman at my morning meeting and found out that she was a hairdresser and I had a mullet and I thought we were perfect together. But I had never done a sexual inventory, right? I didn't know who the sober adult man that I wanted to be is. But I thought if I made a hair appointment in 1 hour of uninterrupted time, I could con her into going out with me. So I made the hair appointment. I conned her into going out with me. I'll never forget. We went out on a Monday night. It was the perfect AA date. You know, the stars were out and the moon was full. And I knew like 30 seconds into this deal that she was mine forever. She didn't even know my name. Didn't matter because I'm the jihad of dating and I was taking her down. So the next day I put flowers on her doorstep and cards on her car and I called 30 times to make sure she hadn't forgotten about me. And the next day I put the flowers on her car and the cards on her doorstep and called 30 or 40 more times to make sure she knew who I was. And then the third day she dumped me because I was freaking insane. Like I was not dating material. And she went her way and I went my way and we ended up going out again. And then we ended up moving in together. And right after we moved in together, here's what she said. Honey, I'm going to go to Hawaii with my friend Tony. Here's what I heard. Honey, I'm going to go to Hawaii and have sex with everybody on the island except you. So I freaked out and I called my sponsor at the time and I said, this is what's going on. What do I do? And he said, I'm going to tell you exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, great, I need direction. He said, I want you to march home and I want you to tell her she's got a choice, you or Hawaii. She can't have both. And if she chooses Hawaii, you pack her bags and you throw her ass out on the street. And I thought, it's a little harsh, but I'm going to be that good AA soldier and follow direction. And I marched home and thank God she was at work. Thank God. And I opened the big book to page 69 where it says now about sex. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Counsel with others is often helpful, but we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And 7 pages prior to that in our literature, it said, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God, which in those 2 paragraphs tells me that I don't have the right to take away you having the dignity of your own experience. My job is to share with you my experience and trust that if I'm seeking a higher power, you're seeking a higher power and I'm not it. So married her. We've been married 27 years. I got a new sponsor. I called a man named Scott Redman that I had heard talk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I need help. And he said in the most beautiful voice I've ever heard in my life, he said, honey, I can help you. And I knew that I was placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And he invited me over. I miss him. He invited me over to his house. We opened the big book to chapter 5. When we got to the third step prayer, we got on our knees, we held hands, and he did the kindest thing anyone's ever done. He read the third step prayer with me. He didn't pray it at me. It wasn't a sponsor to a sponsee or a baby to whatever. It was one alcoholic holding hands with another alcoholic, inviting God into the solution. And then he introduced me to the inventory process as it's outlined in the book, resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. Three areas of my life where alcoholism presents itself the most, where if I treat it like a real piece of business in front of me at all times, I have an opportunity to grow and change in a way that I was unequipped to do when I got here. Resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to actually kill. Excuse me. These resentments must be mastered, but how? I couldn't wish them away any more than I could alcohol. And my favorite, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, which means it didn't have to happen. I just had to think it happened. And I have tremendous mind reading skills. I can read your mind behind your back like nobody's business. So, and I get resentful all the time. I'm 34 years sober. I treat my alcoholism really currently and really cleanly, and I get resentful all the time. And I don't get to pick and choose when they come, but my responsibility is to treat them in alcoholics. Now, let's say I get resentful at, I know it's a shock, my wife. I know it's a stretch. The cause, she said good morning. But I know what she meant. Right? I know what she meant. She meant, when are you going to? Why haven't you? Why didn't you? You're a loser. We're destined to failure. So I get resentful, right? All she said was good morning, but I got alcoholism. And it's, what is it affecting me? It affects my self-esteem because I'm married beneath me. It affects my pocketbook because I wasted way too much money on this woman. It affects my ambition. It makes me want to be less of a good husband. It affects my personal relations because I'm willing to assassinate her character to anybody that'll listen. And it affects my sex relations because I start withholding all of this from her, right? And all she said was good morning, but I got alcoholism, right? And the book tells me exactly what to do with that information. I disregard the other person entirely. The resentment's mine, not her. What are my defects of character that if God were to remove, the resentment would be lifted? I'm punitive, I'm retaliatory, I'm judgmental, I'm insecure, I've got low self-esteem, I'm a people pleaser, I'm sober longer than she is, and I do AA much better than she does. So there could be a little spiritual pride, a little false pride. So I got all of these defects of character that are inflamed, and all she said was good morning. But you guys have given me a set of principle tools that if I take advantage of them, I have an opportunity to know that what's affecting me is alcoholism, to treat it in the right place, and to learn how to live like a married guy. And then the fear part of the inventory, I'll never forget. So that landlord that asked me to leave that apartment, I had been trying to track down for 14 years. And every time I drove past that apartment, it was like a little knife in my chest because I knew I wasn't clean there. And I finally got her phone number the week before my daughter was born. And I called her up and I said, hi, my name's Danny Marsh. I'm sure you don't remember me. And she said, oh, I remember you. And I said, look, I was a really irresponsible tenant and I treated your property with incredible disrespect. And I'm no longer the man that I was when I rented that apartment from you. And I'd like to know what I can do to make it right. And she started crying. And I started crying. We had this beautiful talk. And then I made a mistake. I said, I may owe you a little money. I shouldn't have done it. But she threw out this staggering sum of money. And I'm like, but we just had this spiritual connection. But I did what you told me to do, which was say thank you. And I said, thank you. And I asked her if I could write a series of post-dated checks till I'm like 118 years old. And she said, yes. And she cashed them all the day we checked into the hospital to have my kid. And I'm freaked out. And we're in the labor and delivery room. And it tells me what to do with fear, right? We put fear down on paper. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. So I'm in the labor and delivery room and I'm scared and I write on an inventory I'm afraid I'm going to be an abusive father. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt my unborn child. I'm afraid I'm going to drop her from the changing table. I'm afraid I won't be able to give her all the opportunities that she needs. I'm afraid I can't afford to be a dad. I'm afraid I'm going to run. I'm afraid I'm not going to stay. And I called my sponsor at 3 o'clock in the morning and I read him that inventory. And I got on my knees and I said, "Dear God, please remove my fear of being an abusive father and direct my attention to what you would have me be." And I can tell you, 22 years into this deal, I'm a great freaking dad. I'm a great dad because I don't punish my kid for my alcoholism. And then the sexual part of the inventory, where am I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Everywhere. Do I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Only if I open my mouth. Who did I hurt? I hurt you. I hurt me. There may have been some livestock. I don't remember. Where was I at fault, right? If we treat sex like we would any other problem, where was I at fault? What are my defects of character that are at work here, just like they're at work everywhere else in my life? Am I selfish, self-centered, self-seeking? Am I punitive? Am I just looking out for me? Am I not trusting God? Am I not relying on God? Am I not bringing God into the partnership? What's going on? And the most beautiful part of the sexual inventory is, what should I have done instead? Who's the sober adult married man that I want to be? And the bottom of page 69, it says, in this way, we help shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. The right answers will come if we want them. So all of a sudden, I've got that inventory, which is a blueprint for me to develop a relationship with a power greater than myself that I did not believe in when I got here. And it's the platform for me for which to go, okay, Pop, you take it all. Just take it all and show me who the man is that you need me to be so I can go out and be helpful on the planet. And it's such a tremendous opportunity for me to become a guy that I didn't know I could be when I got here. And where I get into trouble is when I become entrenched in that and think I don't need to keep growing. But then I sit down with a new guy and read chapter 5 and get on our knees and hold hands and read the third step prayer with one another and invite God into the solution, and it all changes again. And so my kid, she was a nationally ranked debater in high school, which did not go well for me. She's way smarter than I'll ever be. And I came home one afternoon and she was not home. She was out driving with her friend, and her friend just got her license. My God bless you. My daughter just got her permit. And I came home and they weren't there. And I freaked out. And I said, "Where are they?" My wife said, "Well, they're out driving." I'm like, I went from being the loving, kind, considerate, thoughtful father to a representative of the California Highway Patrol like that. And I couldn't wait for her to get home. And she got home and I said, "Babe, I got to tell you, you know, you're out driving with Hattie. You just got your permit. She just got her license. That's illegal. You're going to lose." And I laid into her. But she's a nationally ranked debater. So before I finished my argument, she had texted me 4 articles contrary to everything I had just said. And but here's the deal. I'm 30 some odd years sober. But if you come to me, if you attack me, my knee jerk reaction, if you hurt me, my knee jerk reaction is to make you hurt more. It's got to be. So I looked at her and I said, "Babe, I got to tell you, I'm so thoroughly disappointed in your behavior." And she was crestfallen because she loves her dad. And my wife said, "You know what, honey, you can talk to our kid about anything, anytime you want, but you may not do that. That's not a fair fight." So I thought for a second, I thought, one bullet will take them both out. And I went outside and I took a breath and I said, "Pop, who do you need me to be?" And I walked back inside and I looked at my kid and I said, "Babe, I'm so sorry. I've never been the father of a 16-year-old girl before and I don't know how to do this and I get scared. But I can promise you with everything that I've got that I will do my best to never punish you for my fear again. You and I will learn how to do this together." And we've been learning how to do it together ever since. About 4 years ago, I was feeling some discomfort in my chest and feeling discomfort in my jaw, and I didn't know what to do. And I got on my knees and I said, Pop, am I going to be okay? And a little voice came in my head. It was my gay Cuban AA brother, Vincent. And the voice said, I got you, boo. So God says, I got you, boo, which tells me I'm going to be okay. I go to bed. I wake up the next morning. And I'm still in discomfort, and I call my doctor, and he says, get to the freaking hospital now. Those were his words. What I heard was, take a shower, shave, pack a bag, have breakfast, and leisurely go to the hospital. I go to the hospital. I'm having something called sustained ventricular tachycardia. They shoot up my chest. I end up in surgery where they implant a device in my chest. I have a defibrillator pacemaker. I get out of surgery. I go into a coma for 3 days. And then the pandemic hit, right? And the thing about that is I was sponsoring a guy who had 90 days at the time. And when I got out of the coma, he said, thank you. I said, thank you. He goes, yeah, while you were out, John called and Lisa called and John texted and all these people called to see how I was doing. And I said, dude, I was in a coma. Like, I wasn't texting. Like, I don't know what you think a coma is, but I had nothing to do with that. And he had that look in his eye. He had that moment where he knew that he was placed in a position of neutrality in Alcoholics Anonymous, safe and protected, and that he was cared for. And you did that for him while I could no longer do it. And so I got out of that thing, and they told me that I have a little disease in my heart, and I need to take an oral chemotherapy once a week, and it freaked me out. And I called my sponsor at the time, and I said, I'm freaked out about taking this medication. What do I do? And he said, do a meditation. And I said, what? He said, yeah, do a meditation. And I thought, I need a new sponsor because this is not right. But every Sunday night, I do a 5-minute meditation where I invite this medicine to come in and do its job. Thank God from the bottom of my heart that God created a medication that may save my life, and thank it for existing. And I've done it every Sunday night for 4 years. And then I started working with this new sponsor, and I was having problems with my kid. And I said, what do I do? And he said, pray. And I said, oh, great, I need another new sponsor. But the answer keeps coming up, prayer and meditation, prayer and meditation. And I love the 11th step where it says sought to improve. That's my only goal in prayer and meditation, is to seek to improve. It's not to perfect, and it's not to walk on water. It's just to grow a little bit closer. And I'll finish. I tell this story all the time because I never want to forget the power of Alcoholics Anonymous in my house. So Ruby, my daughter, was 7 or 8 years old, and we had a goldfish named Edie the goldfish, who had been with Ruby her whole life. And I came home one night, and Edie was belly up. And I went in and I said, Pumpkin, I got some really sad news. Edie's dead. And she said, wow, Pop, that's really sad. I said, what should we do? She said, you know what, Pop? We should take her back to the ocean and release her back to her family. And I thought, oh my God, that's so sweet. But we live in the valley, and it's 8 o'clock at night, and I want to be a good dad, but not a great dad. And I said, Pumpkin, can you come up with anything else? And she said, yeah, Pop, we can flush her down the toilet. Eventually, she'll end up in the ocean. I thought, I love my kid. So Cindy grabs Ruby. I grab the fish. I throw her in the tank. I said, Pumpkin, is there anything you want to say before we say goodbye? And she said, dear God, thank you for allowing Edie to be with our family this long. Now, please gently take her home to hers. And 14 years ago, my sponsor Scott's dying of liver cancer in the hospital. And 9 years ago, my mom's dying of heart failure. And I'm a runner. I'm not a stayer. I am a runner. And I'm holding Scott's hand, and I'm wiping his forehead, and I'm kissing my mom's cheek. And the only thing that comes into my head is Ruby's prayer. Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have Scotty this long. Now, please gently take him home. Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have a mommy this long. Now, please gently take her home. And what happens for me is if I don't treat my alcoholism like a real piece of business in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I miss the whole thing. And I'm unwilling to allow alcoholism to let me miss anything. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what you're bringing to us, and I don't know what it is you don't want to miss, but I can promise you, if you treat your alcoholism like a piece of business in Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to miss anything ever. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank our speaker, Danny, again.
Mountain Blair, fantastic job.
A fellow alcoholic has been asked to come up and read the promises tonight and lead us out in the Lord's Prayer.